Welcome to Community Conversations, a KMD program dedicated to issues of diversity and social justice. I'm your host, Chris Harwood. Our topic tonight is that of accessibility. One cannot, it seems, these days look for a parking space, cross the street, or enter a building without seeing the well-known symbol of a white seated figure on a blue background. While the inclusion and implementation of such modifications into our surroundings may seem encouraging, it really only begins to scratch the surface. Our program today hopes to shed further light on the subject. What defines a disability or impairment? What are some of the challenges that many of us face that may not usually be perceived as a disability? What does accessibility mean? And what efforts, many of them ongoing or yet to be fully realized, are being made to minimize, if not negate, the problems of accessibility in the Northland? Our guests for this discussion include Bridget Riversmith, a Duluth artist and co-founder and co-leader of the Arrowhead Alliance of Artists with Disabilities, AAAWD, or AAWD, and whose works can be found at her website, redrabbitriversmith.com. She's also the former vice chair of the Duluth Commission on Disabilities. And we have Erin Fontaine, a project coordinator at Access North, the Center for Independent Living of Northeast Minnesota. Their website is accessnorth.net. And finally, Penny Cragen, director of the UMD Office of Disability Services. Their website is d.umn.edu/access. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
Before we get to the issue of accessibility itself, I think it would be helpful if we take a moment to define disability. Is disability as a term a cut and dried distinction? Penny, let's start with you. You're working with such a wide range of disabilities at UMD.
At UMD Disability, our office works with students with both visible and invisible disabilities, and we do use the word disability, and there are varying opinions about the use of that word, but I think a lot of people prefer disability over differently abled or some of the other terms that you'll see. Some of our students very clearly identify with having a disability. It's been part of their life, perhaps ever since they were born. Other students might not. It might be because they have been newly diagnosed with a condition, or it might be because it's invisible and they still are kind of working through that process of what that means for them.
When you define the visible and the invisible to me is, seems like a huge gray area. Bridget, when you think of the term disability, is that a sort of a cut and dried term for you, or is there a broad spectrum of what that means?
Well, both personally and as an advocate, I have a rather nuanced view of disability. I see it from the perspective of the disability rights model of disability, and that is seeing it more as kind of a social construct. It says more about a person's relationship to the society, their environment, rather than any kind of inherent defect or lack of ability. So, and as far as invisible disabilities, I guess I would fall into that category. I'm a person with a psychiatric or social disability. So when you talk about chasm, that's sort of where it feels like I am, too. It's kind of this deep, dark hole. And again, that speaks to the social construct of my disability.
Okay. And Erin?
Yeah, I think just kind of building off of what both Penny and Bridget said is that it is very broad. And I think for different purposes, if you're looking at educational or you're looking at what qualifies under the ADA, there are sometimes some pretty clear, specific things about how many life functions are affected by your diagnosis, but really looking at it as a holistic approach. Mm-hmm. And when we're reaching out and providing services to someone, you know, if you self-identify as a person with a disability, then those services are there and available to support you. You don't need to have some diagnosis or medical term to worry about. Just really depends on the situation, but it is very broad. And a lot of people who have a mental health diagnosis who don't consider it as a disability, they want to separate out mental health, or a lot of people who maybe have a short-term physical disability who don't want to classify themselves as a person with a disability. So it is challenging because with negative stereotypes, a lot of people don't want to be identified as a person with a disability, but it is very broad, and 18 to 20% of the population has some type of a disability. And obviously as we age, the percentages are higher, but that's kind of looking at over the lifespan. You know, there are a lot of people that would meet the legal criteria as having a disability who would not identify themselves as a person with a disability. Yet I also know people who don't meet that legal classifications that they do consider themselves as a person with a disability.
How far can that definition go? Is there a place that you can actually draw the line?
Well, the ADA was recently amended, and it made very clear that any major life function, whether that's a bodily system, whether it's thinking, concentrating, taking care of oneself, even breathing, all of those. So it broadens so that we don't have to argue over, do you have a disability or don't you? As Aaron said, if that person identifies and has a need. And I really appreciate what Bridget said, because we've been trying to talk about, again, the way we look at disability and trying to get rid of the medical model and look at the social model. And the barrier is in the environment or in the attitude of the person. And at UMD, we're not trying to change the person. We're trying to remove the barrier. And so that barrier might be a time constraint, so we can provide extra time on a test. It might be working with the professor to change something in the classroom. It might be as simple as making sure they have a screen reader if they can't see what's on the computer screen. But changing the environment and universal design, which I know Aaron and Access North talk about all the time, is what our goal is. I think all of us look at how can we change the environment so it meets the needs of as many people as possible. Sometimes you can't. A clear example for us would be someone who's deaf and needs an ASL interpreter. You're not going to change the environment. What you're going to do is you're going to provide that interpreter in the classroom so they have access to the information.
Well, you could have a more meaningful conversation about being temporarily able-bodied, you know, or just the human condition. I feel, and I identify myself as a person with a disability because I feel that there's a lot of perspective and insight to be gained from being part of that community. And really, the things that we're advocating for, such as universal design, are really things that benefit all of us and really address the needs of the human condition.
Yes.
Because it's a spectrum, whatever kind of constructs or stereotypes we've invented to identify the polar opposites of where we could or should be. That leaves like a huge gray area along that spectrum where most of us exist. There's like one individual on each pole there. So we really have to, and especially as Aaron said, the longer we live, the more apt we are to develop some sort of infirmity or lose our capacities in some way. So we have to really think about how we construct our environment. And when I talk about that, I don't just mean the built environment, but the social environment as well.
Right. Do you think, any of you, that the stigma of disability is really the biggest impairment to that definition?
Oh, by far.
Yeah. Yes. The attitudinal barrier is the greatest barrier.
Is it? Okay. Well, let's talk about then this term of accessibility, which to the person who's asked, you know, just to quickly define what accessibility means, they think of wheelchair ramps, they think of the electric door openings that so many buildings now feature. When we talk about accessibility, it seems like so many of the statutes are about those physical things, building codes, but really there's a lot more to it, isn't there?
Right. There's a lot more things out there now in terminology talking about the universal design or things like that. But with accessibility, there is a lot in the ADA and other legislation that is talking about programmatic access, telecommunications, you know, the ability to be able to interact, to communicate if you need a TTY or relay service or other ways to communicate over the phone to reach that service, city offices, things like that, whatever it might be. It's not just the physical doors or the stairs or if there's an elevator or not, you know. And I've had a lot of people tell me that I need to fill out this form, and someone says if I'm not legally blind, then they can't help me. Or if my arm isn't broken, they can't help me. But I can't understand what these questions are asking me to fill out or how to process this, or I need somebody to rephrase it, or I need help to clarify. And so, again, with some of the learning disabilities or brain injuries, and there are so many different ways to look at accessibility to that form, to that service, to that business, that the majority of those accommodations are low or no cost for that program to make. And I think when you talk about, is it a slippery slope, is this getting so broad that we're all going to need to have different changes made for accessibility? If we start to make those changes in the program where it just exists that way, that everybody can access those things, then it's so much easier. I know at UMD here, for a lot of classes, there's so many of the notes or the PowerPoints or things online for all the students to access, where it helps to not have to have something different than everybody else, but that everybody can access this. Not only does it help that student with a learning disability, but it helps all the students who have different learning styles.
Right.
And then it doesn't make this disability this different thing. It's something that's creating greater access for all people.
Right.
And sometimes just thinking about signage, how you can identify the door. So maybe there's a sign there that has the room number, and a lot of them will put Braille on there, which is great, but there's not a great population of people who use Braille. So can you also use color coding, or can you use larger print, mm-hmm. or can you have clearer signs or arrows for someone who might not be able to identify that sign otherwise? And I think that's really the whole idea of accessibility, is if we can continue to make some of these changes in the beginning, then they're going to help our community as our populations age. And it doesn't have to be something that's expensive and changed just for one person.
Right. Let's talk about the term universal design. It is a fairly cut and dried list of definitions to help define the principle of universal design. I'll quickly read them. Equitable use, flexibility in use, simple and intuitive, I like that one, perceptible information, tolerance for error, low physical effort, and size and space for approach and use. That seems to be a nicely distilled list, but if one doesn't really think about it, it seems to only talk about the physical world, but really that doesn't. That actually is open to a lot of interpretation for, you know, the way people can approach technology, the way people can approach any of the tools that we use in our lives. And I'm thinking about computers, too, in the workplace, in schools. I've seen so many modifications that can be made to the basic computer. Pads for their wrists when they're using a mouse or a keyboard, whether you're a person with a disability or not, are very useful tools. That's the physical again, but the way the screen looks, the colors that are used, the size of the text, whether there's a voice modulator to read it to you or not. I mean, these are all things that are being done, but is that just scratching the surface?
No, the technology has moved so far forward, and some of it is still specialized, but more and more it's becoming built in. Like Mac has a really excellent text-to-speech program, so you don't need anything extra, but there are screen reading programs that are designed specifically if you have a visual impairment or perhaps a learning disability. There are screen reading programs that include all sorts of built-in aids to help with reading and writing. There are visual organizing tools, and more of these are even available for the iPad. Captioning, that is at UMD where we're finally making some advances, but it's sort of like someday captioning will be there for everything. And everybody will expect it. And it's not just if you have a hearing impairment. What about if it's noisy? What about if you're an English language learner? There's so many people that benefit from captions. And right now, the automatic text programs aren't very accurate. If you go to YouTube, you know, they have a built-in one. But if you try it, it's pretty much gibberish. But pretty soon, I expect that it's going to be there. So the same like curb cuts, when they came, everybody assumed they were just there if you were a wheelchair user. And now everyone expects them. Everyone uses them, you know, mothers with the strollers, everybody. And that's the way captioning will be in the future.
Now, are you talking about captioning of pre-recorded materials? Or are you talking about captioning of a live lecture?
It will be both eventually.
Because I've seen some speech recognition software that is very good, but I know computers are getting better and better and better at this. Now, is that something that UMD is starting to use now?
Well, Dragon's been around, and we have it, and many people buy their own. It takes very little training now. Mm-hmm. But it's not very accurate yet or very good, let's say, for a lecturer to use. It's not as expensive or as much time. It's not as time-consuming as it used to be. And so right now at UMD, if a student with a hearing impairment or someone who needs captioning is in a classroom, ITSS will work with the professor to make sure any media in that class is captioned.
Mm-hmm.
And we're encouraging instructors as they build their courses to build in captioning, because it's always easier to build it in up front than to go back and retrofit.
Retrofit, yeah. Mm-hmm. The technology then, it seems like it's coming into its own. It's starting to really arrive, and it'll start working better and better and better. But you pointed out, and I think we've all sort of touched on it, the barriers to that implementation are not just the invention. It's the implementation, it's the cost effectiveness, it's the culture of understanding as well.
Mm-hmm.
Now, are there people out there that actually combat this understanding or say, come on, I don't have time to deal with this with you. You know, you've got to conform to my world. What is the culture nowadays as far as combating the people who really aren't yet on board with accessibility modification?
I think education is really key. I think it's just a lot of times fear of the unknown. They're concerned if they take this on, what the role would be if they have to make changes or what the cost is going to be. But people with disabilities make great employees and are very hardworking and with the right accommodations in place can really work well. And I think when looking at the universal design, this key is how can you make that be something that's just in place? So with the iPad, for example, there's an app for everything, of course, but I used to help people get adaptive equipment that would be really costly that would do just this one thing. And now with the iPad, you know, you can get all these apps. So if a person who's blind can't identify the dollar bills that they have, there was this great device that was a bill identifier and you slide the bill in there and it would tell you the denomination. And now there's an app that will do that same thing. Mm. Augmentative communication devices, I think, is a really large area as well. With the technology advancing, there's great opportunities for communication devices. You know, things have really expanded and thousands of dollars it would cost them to get it approved and to go through the whole system. And now many apps really do a lot of the same thing for an employer, for an educator, for the community as a whole to see that as something that everybody uses, then it's a lot more acceptable and people are a lot more open and welcome to it. So the more that we can incorporate that into the tools that everybody uses, the more normalized, I guess, I would, you know, in quotes, I would say it is in the society. And then people are a lot more open and welcoming.
Mm-hmm. Most people with disabilities, if you give them a little bit of flexibility, they'll get the job done. And there's a lot of entrepreneurs, very successful people who have a learning disability or ADHD because they're often the creative thinkers. They know how to think outside the box. I think that the real answer is to allow people to use their creativity and to be flexible in how the job is done.
It really is a two-way street, too. It's for the person with that disability to find also creative ways that they can put their two cents into anything that is done in the world.
I think that's key what you said is it's a two-way street. I have people, you know, a lot of times going both ways. You know, a person with a disability might be upset that their employer isn't offering a certain accommodation or, you know, working with them. But it's really important to request that accommodation and to be able to look at what options they are. And it's really empowering if you, as that person with a disability, is able to share the ideas that you have or what's worked before, what you've already tried. It takes a lot of that responsibility off that employer to think, well, I've never dealt with this before. I don't even know how to offer that. It takes away some of their fear. If I can say, you know, this is what I need to do this job and I can complete the functions that are required of this job, the major duties of this job. And I think some people think that I have to hire this person because they have a disability. Well, if they have the equal qualifications and equally able to do this job, then we all deserve that equal opportunity. And a lot of people with disabilities that have experienced them their whole lives, like Penny said, they've learned to adapt to those barriers that they experience. They really are hardworking problem solvers, learn to be really good advocates. And those are a lot of skills that a person with a disability might not have had the opportunity to build as well. And so focusing on the strengths that person with a disability might bring instead of what their concerns or worries might be of their costs. You know, I think it's just really important to kind of look at that whole picture and that it's definitely a give and take. It's got to be communication happening there. But there are some jobs that can't be accommodated for certain disabilities. And an example that we use a lot with trainings and things is, you know, if I'm legally blind, I probably am not going to be qualified for a job as a bus driver. The majority of jobs and the majority of disabilities can be accommodated to work together, you know, if you really look into options. And so there are a lot of great services. You know, there's vocational rehabilitation services through the state that really can have somebody have an employment counselor that can help look into these accommodations, help make those connections between the employer and the employee or potential employee to look at possible accommodations. There are different funding streams or options that can sometimes cover those accommodations so that small business owner doesn't have to worry about due to that cost. And so there's all those barriers or unknowns that if we can kind of get that education and awareness out there, it makes a huge difference.
Penny, you had mentioned to me the other day an old versus a new model of how to approach accessibility. The old model, fix the disability, and the new model being fix the environment. Mm-hmm. I guess there are ways in which I see that both can still happen. It's not like one is completely without merit as far as the old model being fix the person.
We talk to students about this because sometimes they come out of a special ed model where it really is the medical model and they see themselves as there's something wrong with me and people have been trying to fix me. And then they come to UMD and they go, I don't want any more of that. And we don't want that to happen because we want them to come to us and use whatever accommodations or supports will provide access. So when I talk to them about, well, it's not that, you know, we look at it from the social model that says, what are the barriers in the environment and how can we remove them, or how can we start out designing courses or places so that they're there for everyone? Mm-hmm. And that really changes, I think, for a lot of students, their willingness to say, yeah, mm-hmm, this is important, and to work with our office. And we think that we're so far ahead in the U.S. That is not true. I went to an international conference, and they are all talking about inclusive education. And in fact, most of those European countries have already signed the UN Declaration on the Rights of, what's the official title? You know it, Bridget?
The UN Declaration on the Rights of All Persons with Disabilities.
And I don't think we have yet, have we? I know there was a push, and I don't know whether the Senate has signed that. So it's not just the U.S., it's globally, is beginning to look in a different way.
Hmm.
Sometimes there's some debate between the universal design and the modifications because, you know, there are sometimes modifications that need to happen, like Penny talked about with an ASL or American Sign Language interpreter. You know, it's not going to probably be common practice to just have an American Sign Language interpreter in every classroom to try to make that more universal. That wouldn't be cost effective. That wouldn't make sense. It wouldn't be for the greatest use. So there are going to be situations where you want to look at making a specific accommodation for that person or that situation, but that yet still striving for this universal design where it can be included in all things. It's kind of an, you know, a step or a, again, back to a spectrum situation. But if we try to hide it or just not talk about it, then there are so many people in the community that don't have that education or experience or understanding where we just can't get past those barriers.
Right. I want to ask you all one more question before we go, and that is sort of a barometer on where we are in the Duluth area, in the Twin Ports, with accessibility. Mm-hmm. And what is the biggest challenge that we still have to face in this community?
You know, I think, like we talked about before, with the physical access, the transportation, and our community as a whole is very difficult. At the Center for Independent Living, we kind of look at a 9-county area of northeastern Minnesota. And so I think we have some great things in place in Duluth being a larger community, that there are a lot of great resources and supports here. There are a lot more opportunities for people with disabilities to get involved in different programs and you know, be involved in the community, which is great. So I think we've come a long way in a lot of areas. There are a lot of great community groups and organizations and disability pride in our community, which is great. But I think probably the biggest barrier, like a lot of other communities, is the attitudinal mm-hmm. barriers mm-hmm. to access, that a person doesn't think or a business doesn't feel that I need to make changes for that one person or doesn't understand how to do that. And a lot of times it's not that they don't want to, they just don't understand how or have never addressed it before. And I think the biggest thing is to continue to provide more education. And if my attitude is that I don't need this, I don't want this, then I'm not open to hearing it, no matter how much, it, you know, we try to provide opportunities in the community. So I think the biggest thing is that attitudinal barrier and the accessibility. That's kind of the main area in our Duluth community, and continue to come together. You know, people with disabilities in our community, you know, there's some groups of people who have a mental health disability who might really see themselves as a community and interact together. But if we can bring people together as a whole across disability, just like Penny said too, you know, really inclusive of all people is really important.
Great. Okay. Penny?
Well, at UMD as a campus, there are still small barriers, but as a whole, the physical barriers are addressed pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
The attitudinal barriers are there. We know there are many individuals who have a mental health condition or a chronic health condition where there are attitudinal barriers, and they don't feel free to share that with other people on campus because of the attitudes. And I think that happens a lot in the employment field, too.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think we still have a lot of work to do in that area, I think, both as a campus, but also in the larger community. I think there's a lot of barriers to employment, especially for individuals who have those conditions.
Mm-hmm.
A group that we're beginning to work with more and more is individuals with autism or Asperger's, and there's still a lack of understanding. There's a lack of opportunities, and that is going to be a group that's growing in numbers. And so I think as a society, we need to look at how we understand that and what opportunities we provide.
Bridget?
There's a lot of unanswered questions that you've posed over the course of the conversation, but one of the things I'd really like to highlight as a continuing challenge in our community is the dearth of services for people with mental illness. And that is a community within the disability community that continues to be defined and treated through the medical model of disability.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's there in the title, mental illness.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Again, it's a major social construct and perhaps the most stigmatized of all disabilities. Irving Goffman was the social scientist in the 1960s who coined the term stigma. And it means basically a brand or a stain that is indelible, it won't come out. He said it involves not so much a set of concrete individuals who can be separated into two piles, the stigmatized and the normal. It's a pervasive two-role social process in which every individual along the spectrum of human existence participates in both roles, at least in some connections, in some phases of life.
Mm-hmm.
It's a double-edged sword, and it can easily cut you. Say you spend most of your life as an able-bodied person, and you develop some views about infirmity. You associate infirmity or disability with weakness or lack of value, but all of a sudden you've developed a disability. Now that edge is turned towards yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You've internalized those attitudes and now you suffer from them.
Yeah.
This is really the social aspect that needs to be pointed at and held under a lens that we need to retrofit. And it really needs to happen in Duluth because Duluth has one of the highest suicide rates. We have quite a lot of group homes for people with mental illness. People are sent up to Duluth from all over the state. And we're kind of reaching capacity. And at the same time, funding is being cut and cut again and cut again so that a lot of kids who can't gain access to healthcare or intervention that they need, some of them end up in juvenile detention centers instead.
Right.
And for adults, since there was this indeed good-hearted push to close the institutions, the community supports have not held, again, because the funding keeps draining away.
Yeah.
And so their option is the penitentiary.
Now, is that cut in funding, is that state, local, is that federal?
All levels.
Yes, because, again, it's institutionalized stigma.
Yeah.
It's the attitudes we have towards people with mental illness, that they are lazy, corrupt, dangerous.
That's a good one.
Anytime we have news of someone letting loose with a gun in a crowded shopping mall or a school or something like that, there's a huge backlash towards people with mental illness.
Wow.
And statistics support the fact that people with mental illness are less likely to be violent. They're more likely to be a victim of violent crime. And I identify myself as a person with a disability, and I tell people what that disability is. So I can put a face on this. I've spent a lot of time in institutional environments ever since I was a kid, and I have internalized a lot of stigma, and this is the way that I am trying to dull that sword on both sides.
I like that term. That's great.
I'm just trying to wear away those edges
because
those attitudes are the source of disability. Those attitudes are the source of our suffering. So if I identify myself as a person with a psychiatric disability, I can have that conversation with people.
Great.
Just building off what Bridget said, I think is so empowering to be able to have those conversations about diversity and to be able to identify that there is such great diversity when you're looking at it. Creating that awareness at an early age, every single one of us can make a difference by really just changing our language, changing our views, changing our perspective, changing how we interact with one other person.
Well, and we're all interdependent. We have some really big problems. Everybody's got a take on it. We need to value everyone.
I imagine some of the bigger problems would be a lot less if the smaller problems, like our various disabilities, were handled with grace and dignity.
Number five, principle of universal design, tolerance for error. That's a good starting point.
That is indeed. That should be our ending point, too. Well, thank you so much, everyone.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thanks, Chris.
Thank you.
That is all the time we have today. I want to thank our guests, Bridget Riversmith, a Duluth artist and member of the Arrowhead Alliance of Artists with Disabilities, whose works can be found at her website, redrabbitriversmith.com. Erin Fontaine, a project coordinator at Access North, the Center for Independent Living of Northeast Minnesota. Their website is accessnorth.net. and Penny Cragen, Director of the UMD Office of Disability Resources. Their website is d.umn.edu/access. We hope you have found this conversation enlightening, and we thank you for listening to Community Conversations, a KUMD program dedicated to issues of diversity and social justice. I'm your host and producer, Chris Harwood, with assistance tonight from Seamus Johnson. Our theme music is by Pat Matheny. Our topic of conversation on the next program will be civil rights and GLBT. Where is Minnesota on GLBT civil rights, civil unions, health coverage, and the legalization of marriage? That's next month on Community Conversations here on 103.3 KUMD. Community Conversations is a KUMD production with support provided by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Thank you for listening.